The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Sleep Medicine Update is presented by Dr. Timothy Barrero.
Good morning. Thanks for the committee the opportunity to speak. I do apologize for having no tie. The ketchup did win the battle this morning. I do apologize. I do time to talk very fast, so the countdown will begin and we'll be off. I did these slides in the concept of which I'm not going to give you a lecture, but get you salient points, what you need to know for the boards about the two subjects that I was asked to present. So with that said, there's always no disclosures, and these are the learning objectives. When we talk about sleep, there's not going to be many questions or at least concepts they're going to ask you about the physiological aspect of it. There's two different segments, non-REM and REM, and again, they won't need to know this. But I think what you do need to know is summarized in this slide, if they may ask you that, and that is, when you were born, you need equal amount of REM and non-REM sleep, and as you get older, about the age of 25 or beyond, your REM and non-REM sleep go down, and that remains relatively constant throughout. So if they ask you that, that's a shame on them. There's other important topics that they need to know. The most important sleep disorder known to the medical world is actually insomnia. It is not sleep apnea, okay? So insomnia is the most common, and what you need to know about insomnia is that most of the time you don't need medication. There's a sex-male ratio that's more common in females, and there are many different types. One called persistent insomnia, that's the one that you need cognitive behavioral therapy. So here's the answer question that they're gonna ask you. Like everybody in this room, you are sleep deprived. It does not mean you have insomnia or the medical insomnia. You have the psychophysiologic aspect of insomnia of just working too much. So they're gonna ask you, are you sleep deprived or are you a pathologic insomniac? And that's the question. So using that, what do we know? Which of the following statements about insomnia is false? A, 50% of insomnia have a psychiatric disorder. B, various physical symptoms are associated with insomnia. C, meta-analysis of 20 studies concluded that persistent insomnia is associated with doubling the risk of depression. Or D, insomnia is a rare disorder. The answer is D. A is true. When you think about primary insomnia, you must look for depression and other mental health disorders. And that is also answered in C. We know that insomnia presents in a variety and plenitude of different symptoms, and that's why it's very common. So what you need to know about the treatment, again, if you're sleep deprived, then get sleep hygiene. If you are primary insomniac, look for psychiatric disorders and do not treat any one of these disorders with short-acting medications. Things like Ambien are great, right, in a rap song, but they're not the answer for the boards, okay? So you do not need to know those, okay? This is what you need to know about insomnia. Don't lose too much sleep about it. So next is moving on to sleep apnea. A 23-year-old is referred for excessive sleepiness, having fallen asleep while driving. She often struggles to remain awake. She occasionally feels weak when laughing. Once she fell asleep, she fell to the ground while laughing during a party and could not get up for about a few minutes. She is sleepy. When she is sleepy, she images seeing animals. Once she is terrified to find herself unable to move upon awakening. Which of the following tests is most appropriate? A, order a sleep study. B, multi-sleep latency test. C, cognitive behavioral therapy. D, discuss sleep hygiene. Again, there should be some key features in this stem which you should recognize. And what they're going to ask you about narcolepsy, which this is, versus, right, being sleep deprived is the classic features thereof. Sleep disorder or a sleep study is for people with obstructive sleep apnea. There is no risk factors associated in that stem. B is the correct answer. C, cognitive behavioral therapy is the answer for primary insomnia. apnea, and D, hygiene is for everybody who has some kind of sleep behavioral problem. So there are many different causes of sleep disorders. As mentioned, insufficient sleep, that is all residency and interns, including attendings, periodic limb movement disorder, which is a clinical diagnosis, shift work disorder, but again, they're going to outline when they work, how long they work, and whether or not they change their sleep patterns. And if you do get the answer for shift work disorder, the answer is not medication, right? It is getting them off that sleep pattern and getting them to a regular work pattern. So narcolepsy is a genetic disorder. It's diagnosed by a multi-sleep latency test. You must identify the key salient features in the question stem in order to identify it, and that is cataplexy, cataplexy, cataplexy. Sudden brief episodes of neuromuscular weakness. That is not common in someone who's just tired and drives home to work because they were on call for 36 hours, right? So 100% specificity when it comes to narcolepsy. All those things in those slims, sleep paralysis, waking up thinking of animals, those are all abnormal findings associated with sleep, and those should be very key features that you should think about when you do that. Next question, which of the following statements about clinical manifestations of narcolepsy is true? True. A, affected persons tend to have a low body mass index. B, complex auditory hallucinations are common. C, rapid eye movement, sleep can occur at any time during the day. D, symptoms usually begin in midlife. The answer is C. So all affected persons with narcolepsy, if you don't sleep well, you look like me. You tend to be mostly overweight, right? Because hormones get regulated and your sleep patterns, and that's extremely important. If you have auditory hallucinations, you need to see a psychiatrist. That is not a sleep problem, okay? C, rapid eye movement disorder is the classic definition of what narcolepsy is, and I'll show this. People with narcolepsy go into REM sleep in 10 minutes. Within 10 minutes, they're in REM sleep, not just sleepy, right? Or people falling asleep during this lecture. That's not narcolepsy, okay? So usually sleep begins in midlife. It is early in life, 18 years of age, early adulthood is more likely, not midlife like myself. There's no crisis involved. This is narcolepsy, right? What you see on this slide is falling asleep, watching the news means you're tired. Giving the news and falling asleep, that's narcolepsy. This is a multi-sleep latency test. As you can see, what you do is you put someone in a room, in a dark room, and you say, don't fall asleep. And what you see here is REM sleep is entered within 10 minutes in two of the three naps. REM sleep, okay? So they're out. That's narcolepsy. So if you have sleep apnea with key features, it's a polysomnography. If you have narcolepsy with classic features, main one being cataplexy, it's a multi-sleep latency test, very good. Which of the following statements about pathogenesis, diagnosis, and treatment of narcolepsy is true? A, patients report a normal quality of life. B, multi-sleep latency test is optional, wrong. C, cataplexy often is reduced with a low dose of an antidepressant. And D, no genetic factors are present. So the answer is, which of the following is true? They all report an abnormal quality of life. Multi-sleep latency test is not optional. It is the diagnostic test of choice. And see, cataplexy is often reduced with low doses of antidepressants. I will promise you they're not going to ask you any of the medications needed for the treatment of narcolepsy. I promise you that. It's not a sleep board. It's internal medicine, right? The determinant competency, if that. They want you to recognize it and get it to the right person. That's what they're going to ask you. It is genetically based, no doubt about it. Okay? These are the different medications. They're not going to ask you to put it on there so that you know if different medications are used for different processes. Please refer that out. Okay, next, moving on from insomnia, from narcolepsy is sleep apnea. 52-year-old is evaluated undergoing a total knee arthroscopy weeks ago. Through the surgery, procedure was uncomplicated. He required reintubation and recovery room following persistent hypoxemia. He is extubated 24 hours later without difficulty. Chest radiograph is normal, as is the rest of the hospitalization. He's on three medications for high blood pressure. Ding, ding, ding. Examinations revealed normal temperature and blood pressure. His heart rate is normal. Examination, low-lying soft palate, thick neck. rest of the examination is normal. In that stem, you should identify key features. They have to give you the features to identify sleep apnea syndrome, and this is how they're going to present it in the boards: unrecognized sleep apnea in someone who's an intern who gets consultated because now they're in your ICU. Which of the following treatments is the most appropriate next step in this management? A, overnight pulse oximetry. B, polysomnography. D, stop bang questionnaire. D, no additional testing. So the best answer is polysomnography. And you say, well, he got through the surgery. That's nothing. This is unrecognized disease. He has got key features that are associated with sleep apnea, and sleep apnea is associated with utter mortality features, and thus they want you to test him. All right, so A, why it's not, we have no idea what to do with an overnight pulse oximetry. And this is what residents ask me all the time, but Dr. Barrero, Dr. B, we do this all the time. Yeah, this is boards. This isn't what you do in New Jersey, in California, or in Pennsylvania, or even Youngstown, Ohio. They want to know what the competency and the best test to diagnose sleep apnea is polysomnography. When they did multiple tests to try to determine whether or not you can use an overnight pulse oximetry to determine whether or not you have sleep apnea, the answer is no. So please do not answer overnight pulse oximetry for anything on your boards. B, polysomnography is the answer. Stop bang questionnaire is a validated questionnaire to tell you whether or not your patient's at risk pre-surgery to have sleep apnea. Then you still have to do the test, right, which is a polysomnography. No additional tests in someone who got reintubated is unreasonable, and he's on 3 medications. Your risk factors you should know. At this point in your career, in your residency training, we should be above and beyond knowing what your risk factors are, and they are shown here. More likely in males, more likely if you're obese. It is more likely the older you get, and there are associated medical risks associated with sleep apnea. Your physical exam findings will do this. I noted when I reviewed the MICSAP questions over the past previous years is all the questions are now adding neck circumference and BMI to the regular questions. That was not done 5 to 6 years ago. So they know that they're going to start, right, putting those in regular questions, so it won't be a key feature that you identify in non-risk questions. So macronathia or Mallampati score is used frequently. Low-lying soft palate is a high risk for obstructive sleep apnea. This is the classic retronathia associated with a high risk of obstructive sleep apnea, probably one of the highest. Right? We know there are cardiovascular risk factors. Now, I'm not going to get into the main question here, is we get consulted all the time by someone in AFib because they want to rule out sleep apnea. The truth of the matter is, yeah, they probably do, and it helps with management, but they're not going to ask you that on the boards because there's no study to document it. Okay? So what we do need to know is there's associated risk factors with untreated sleep apnea, and that was identified in this wonderful study in 2005, where they took patients with an AHI, which is an apnea-hypopnea index, normal is less than 5. These people had AHIs of 25 versus a normal cohort, which is an AHI of 2, and they said, if you have sleep apnea, you're more likely to have a stroke or a cardiovascular event. That is why this is a competency board test and why you need to know sleep apnea, because you're more likely to have an MI or a stroke if you don't treat it. Okay? If you don't think that there's risks associated with driving and sleep apnea, look at the 10 studies on this slide. It is clearly a risk. But remember, you must identify the people who have narcolepsy. You must identify the people who have just poor sleep hygiene versus the people that have additional risk factors for obstructive sleep apnea. There are many different questions associated with the complexities of sleep apnea, and they are shown here on this slide, and depending on multiple different literatures that are out there. Drug-resistant hypertension, not regular hypertension, but drug-resistant hypertension. Now, here's the caveat. Is treating obstructive sleep apnea, if you're on 3 hypertension medication, reduces the risk minimally. Minimally. That's the sad part. Do we do it? Yeah, we do it, right? But it is the key. It must be drug resistant. Heart failure, severe obesity, hypertension, things that we already mentioned. Now, I love this slide because the next one is extremely important, because when I reviewed on how I was going to present this, the next question only 30% of people get. And the answer is all these questions are right, right? Find X. Here it is, right? There are 30 students in 10 years. Mary and Mark want to find out year 10's favorite color. Mary asked 30 people, Mark asked 150 people. Mark says, my conclusion is more likely to be reliable than Mary's. Why is that the answer? Because Mark is a male, right? The first cells are probably lonely. Yeah. What ended in 1896? 1895. That's right. And then my favorite, Brian has 50 slices of cake. He eats 48 of them. What does he have now? He has type 1 diabetes, right? The answer is all the questions, they're right, but they're just not right, okay? So the reason that that's important is because I showed you at the top of this, when I review now on you take MCSAP questions, it says, how likely did your other colleagues get this question right? And I'm amazed when the residents show me this and only 30%. Do not miss this question, right? A 59-year-old is evaluated for a 4-month history of lower extremity swelling and dyspnea. Medical history is positive for dyslipidemia, hypertension, and diabetes. It used to be called metabolic syndrome. I don't know what they call it now. His current medications are above or below or shown. Blood pressure is high, BMI is high, neck circumference is large, right? All key features, right? Of what? Key features of sleep apnea. Test reveals elevated hemoglobin, and a blood gas that shows hypercapnia and hypoxemia. Echo shows normal ejection fraction and dilated right ventricle is echo and chest x-ray are normal. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? A, chain Stokes, B, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, C, interstitial lung disease, D, obesity hypoventilation. Please, this is obesity hypoventilation. It looks like heart failure, but it's not heart failure. Right? So again, how do you know? You must know your key risk factors associated with sleep apnea. If you do not, you're going to get this question wrong, like the 30% that only got it right, as noted in the previous, right? It's not right. You want it right, right? You need the point. So when you get this, how do you look at obesity of hypoventilation? Look for the key features, BMI greater than 30. As your BMI goes up, the higher the risk, right? So that's how that goes. Unable to attribute to other etiologies, the mechanism was unclear. Sleep apnea is common, right? They have sleep apnea, but this is a variant of sleep apnea. And why the boards want you to know it is because your mortality is 30 to 40% higher. 30 to 40%, right? So if that's your loved one and your patient, don't you want to know that? And the answer is true, right? So pulmonary hypertension is more commonly associated with obesity hypoventilation than it is with obstructive sleep apnea. More common, right? It's the hypoxemia that drives it, may likely. So what do? We say all the time we get consults because the family member or spouse says they snore. The answer is there's only positive predictive value about 64%. So snoring itself is a risk factor, but there's other causes nonetheless. A 30-year-old is evaluated for daytime fatigue for 9 months. He denies falling asleep while driving, but falls asleep at other times during the day. It reports no leg symptoms, no significant medical history. His exam shows a BMI of 33 and a neck circumference that's enlarged. Phalanx is normal, lung exam and neurologic exam is unremarkable. In addition to counseling regarding sleep hygiene, right? Normal sleep hygiene, go to bed at a certain time, get a proper amount of rest, decrease your caffeine intake, all those good things. And weight loss, which of the following is the most appropriate management in this patient? A, alcohol abstinence, B, initiate therapy with Ambien, C, order iron studies, D, refer for polysomnography. Please, the answer is D. So we all advise people to drink less. That is true. It's helpful, but it's not going to save their life and reduce their risk of cardiovascular and stroke events, which I showed you in an earlier slide. Initiate Ambien, again, great if you're Jay-Z, but it's not good for the board, so don't answer it. Order iron studies, the answer is, yeah, if you have restless leg syndrome, we do it, but it is not a survival benefit, it's a quality of life improvement, so you don't need to know it, right? Refer for polysomnography is the best test. They're gonna want you to know that, please answer that correctly. Obstructive sleep apnea, again, they don't sleep well. The key is know the key features on the physical exam and don't rely on the partners. One of the questions that get answered all the time, or you'll see, is mainly what happens in practice versus competency-based questionnaires, and that is, are there testing that helps you determine if someone has sleep apnea? And the answer is yes and no. Screening tests have a low quality of evidence. I didn't make it up. It's in your journal, the Annals of Internal Medicine, recently published, right? The three ones that are out there are the Epworth Sleepiness Score, the Berlin Questionnaire and the Stop Bang. This again is marketed. Epworth is a proprietary institution, so we had to ask approval, but it asks you if it's greater than 10 means you're sleepy. Does that mean you have sleep apnea? No, right? If you think someone has sleep apnea, do you give them the Epworth Sleepiness Score? The answer is no. You do the polysomnography. Right? So it's a nice thing to do, but it ain't going to get you the answer. So don't answer any of these questions on the boards. Right? If you think they have sleep apnea, what do? You test them. This is the stop bang. It's been validated, used as a pre-anesthetic risk for people who may have sleep apnea and unknown prior to surgery. If you think they have sleep apnea, you can do this test, but it doesn't give you the diagnosis, right? You do the test. So that's the key. So polysomnography is the diagnostic test of choice. There is more and more complexities because of the economics of healthcare of whether or not you should do home testing. I hope they do not ask you that. That is for pulmonary fellows or sleep fellows that are passing their boards. But if they do, the answer is everybody goes to the lab unless you have no risk factors. Then you would wonder why you test them in the first place, right? So if you have high blood pressure, you go to the lab. If you have heart disease, you go to the lab, right? If you've had a stroke, you go to the lab. If you don't have any problems, okay, maybe do them at home. Right? So that's what you need to know. Again, I hope they don't ask you that, but I put it on just in case. There are many different causes of sleep apnea, but nonetheless, if they do show you a polysomnography, I apologize, and we can all storm the AOBIM and hunt them down, because that is just unfair. But if you're not sure, look for the airflow and look for the thoracic cage. If the thoracic cage is moving, but there's no flow, that means it's strangulated at the top and the chest is moving. That's an obstructive event. Right? If they're both flat, then it's a central event. That means the nerves aren't getting to the muscles. That's the best way I can tell you how to look at that. A 60-year-old male's evaluated 3 months' history of loud snoring and gasping during sleep. He frequently falls asleep in a chair while reading. Examination reveals a high blood pressure, a BMI that's high, neck circumference that's high, and a low-lying south palate. Everybody get the risks, see the risks. Polysomnography has disclosed severe sleep apnea syndrome. 44, normal less than 5. Which of the following is the most appropriate treatment? A, continuous positive airway pressure. B, nocturnal oxygen therapy. C, oral device therapy, upper airway surgery. The answer is A, and then A, right? So, Dr. B, what about nocturnal oxygen therapy? Yeah, we all do it in clinical practice, right? The New England Journal of Medicine article in 2015 says it does not work. Do we do it? Sure. This is competency-based questions, not what we do regular in our practice in Las Vegas, right? So oral dental appliances help. They're costly. They're not as effective as for obstructive or CPAP therapy. Upper airway surgery is nice if you have have sleep apnea and a low AHI, but it only works for a couple months. So when in doubt, when always in doubt, when you have sleep apnea, regardless of the stage, what is the answer? CPAP. Okay, so we do all kinds of things to help our patients. I hope we do those on a regular basis, lose weight, but CPAP is the primary treatment of choice. A 45-year-old obese male presents with snoring, witnessed apneas, and daytime sleepiness. History reveals hypertension, depression, and atrial fibrillation. Study demonstrates severe obstructive sleep apnea. You initiate CPAP therapy. Which of the following outcomes would be most likely to improve with this therapy? A, hypertension, B, sleepiness, C, mood or depression, and D, lower CRP levels. Well, the answer to this question is hard to understand, but it's B, right? In severe sleep apnea, CPAP improves sleepiness. I already mentioned to you, we talk all the time about this significant or, right, this idea that if you are on 3 hypertensive, get a sleep study. And the answer is the boards want you to do that. You should identify it. But treatment of sleep apnea with 3 hypertensives reduces, right, the blood pressure by 3 millimeters. Right? You got medication to do better than that. I'm not saying don't do it because there's other risk factors that are associated which may be reduced, but the answer is it's really not the best therapy. It improves their quality of sleepiness, right? In the long run, it may reduce depression. Lower CRP levels was proven in a study called the CNAP study, and it's negative, right? So treatment is CPAP. It's the best for mild. It's the best for moderate. It's the best for severe. But what we know in the long-term outcome is that if you have mild disease, which is defined by an AHI, an apnea hypopnea index less than 15, there's where your blood pressure control proven in the literature is, not for the severe sleep apneic patients. So that's a very small salient feature you may want to know. We talk about all kinds of surgeries and different devices, right? And get your, what's it called, your happy spelled backwards on the radio, that annoying commercial, right? Those things don't help. All right. So nonetheless, the best treatment is CPAP regardless across the board. There's interesting studies looking at weight reduction in bariatric surgery. And let me just sum that up. None of them are better than CPAP therapy. You can lower someone's CPAP. So if you're morbidly obese and you went for bariatric surgery, what they found is you reduced your amount of CPAP, but you did not eliminate your CPAP. Right? You reduced your sleep apnea, but you did not eliminate your sleep apnea. So lower weight patients, maybe, and people with morbid, supermorbid obesity and severe sleep apnea, bariatric surgery, again, does a lot of other things, but it's not the savior when it comes to sleep apnea syndrome. So nasal CPAP is the mainstay of treatment. I hope you get that. I think I said it at least 1,000 times. Nonetheless, compliance is extremely difficult. They're not going to ask you whether or not or how to look at that, and that simply is just asking your patients. And again, most of the time, the answers will become clearly evident because of the economics. So sleep apnea is common yet underdiagnosed. You're going to see someone who's in surgery and postoperative who gets into complication, identify your risk factors, know those. Overnight pause thermography remains the standard to test. Home oxygen therapy only if you're not in any problems. Most patients continue to have sleepiness despite sleep apnea due to noncompliance, continued weight gain, or sleep deprivation. So all those other things that you talk to your patient about is certainly important, but for competency-based questions, they're going to need you to know when to order the sleep test, right, and CPAP therapy. That'll get you where you need to go. We know that there's obstructive sleep apnea. We also know there's central sleep apnea, and they'll probably ask you at least 4 or 5 of these. No, they won't do that, right? The answer is extremely complex. So what they will want you to know, and again, if they do this, please, we'll storm the thing. As you can see, there's no movement and no flow. No movement and no flow versus movement of the chest. That's central sleep apnea. What you do need to know and why it's extremely important about central sleep apnea is this. This is Chain-Stokes respiration. And why Chain-Stokes is extremely important for medicine doctors who are in the forefront of seeing all the patients in the hospital is it carries a significant mortality, right? And that's what they want you in order to bridge. So a 55-year-old history of systolic heart failure with EF of 35% presents with symptoms of frequent awakening and daytime sleepiness. His wife states that he breathes rapid and slowly all the time. Current medications are shown. Examination shows lungs are clear, bilateral leg edema. He's found to have central sleep apnea. Which of the following would be the best treatment in this patient? A, CPAP, B, oxygen, C, adaptive servo-ventilation, C, D, ACE inhibitor, E, auto CPAP. The answer is D, ACE inhibitors. When you have central sleep apnea, your job is to treat the underlying disorder. If you have Parkinson's that leads you to central sleep apnea, you treat the Parkinson's, right? If you have ALS, I'm sorry, but the answer is treat the ALS. So the answer is the key is to treat the underlying disorder. So there's two things on there, and board CPAP does not work in central sleep apnea because they stop breathing. So you need a backup ventilatory rate in order to add the breath when someone is not breathing. So that's why A is not the answer. Oxygen therapy, I already said, doesn't work for sleep apnea. It's not going to work for central sleep apnea. Adaptive servo-ventilation, I would say 3 years ago, may have been the answer. It is not. And I don't know how to tell you that, but I'll show you it in the next slide when the moratorium came out from the American Sleep Academy, right? So the best answer in anybody with central sleep apnea, right, is treat the underlying disorder. So adaptive servo-ventilation, this came out. There was one study that proved it, and then all the board questions came out thereafter. And it was in MixApp and in MedStudy, right? But it should no longer be there. I hope they don't do it. I don't know where it's at, but at least you're prepared in case they do. Okay, don't do that anymore. Which of the following is not associated with positive airway therapy in heart failure patients with central sleep apnea? Which of the following is not associated with positive airway pressure in heart failure? A, improved nocturnal oxygenation. D, increased injection fraction. C, lower norepinephrine levels. D, increase in the distance of walked. E, survival. The answer is E, survival. This is complex, and this is interesting, and there's the study down at the bottom if you're not sure or you think I'm lying. The answer is it improved a lot of things, all the things that you think would improve survival, but unfortunately it didn't. It lowered, right, norepinephrine levels. It improved nocturnal oxygenation. In central sleep apnea, right, the use of this backup device, right, or interventions, improved ejection fraction somewhere as much as 15%, but it did not improve survival. And this was the largest study known, published in 2015, called the Canadian CPAP trial therapy. And what it proved is exactly what I showed here. No, p-value is 0.54, did not improve survival, right? So the best therapy for central sleep apnea, while it improves all the things that you want your patients to have. So in clinical practice, do it, right? In the boards, don't do it. Treat the underlying disorder. That's the key between the two, right? So in summary, as I have 2 minutes left, sleep apnea is common. It increases with age. Know your risk factors, right? Polysomnography mammography is the gold standard to test. Multi-sleep latency test for narcolepsy. Home testing for high clinical suspicion, but no significant morbidities, right? Weight loss may be helpful in mild to moderate disease, but CPAP and all.